in the NBA, and Tony's not, I mean, it's just not going to happen, but you try to convince them, but at the same time, I want them to dream big as long as they're working hard. But then again, you have to have that talk and say, hey, let's just take care of you getting better today. But, you know, let them dream.
By the way,
it is different mentality.
Terrific crowd today. They announced 14-9 over there. Whatever the crowd was.
With no students.
With no students and a 1 o'clock start. And you name me a better basketball market, I guarantee you, Billy Kennedy rolled out there today and looked up and went, oh, my gosh.
Oh, you want to see what happened? Because we've always said, Tony, the only other markets we put comparable to us when we started doing this show, I mean, Lexington's like Lawrence, Kansas, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Durham, North Carolina. I mean, they're something completely different. We said Fayetteville and Columbia. Tune into the SEC. Tune into ESPN2 tonight at 9 o'clock and see how empty Auburn, Missouri, and Columbia is tonight.
You're exactly right. Griffith is
able to count the crowd.
Griffith, somebody who loves college basketball like I do,
mm-hmm.
It's a blessing to do the show in a place where we've been on for 2 hours now, and I still have all lines currently jammed. I'm going to show people this that are watching us on the
People care, Tony. People care about the program. It means a lot to the individuals that show up. And
I told Barnsey that.
Pay the money for the tickets, yep. And work hard. And it says a lot about this program for these people to come out. And I'm really happy for the fans that showed up today and cheered them on. It was very loud.
Back to the phones we go. It's fun. It matters here. We've got great basketball fans. What Raymere started, let no man tear asunder. Back to the phones we go. Let's get our next phone call in. Great Mark Griffin, who, talk about a guy it matters to. You can ask him right now. When he first put that uniform on, got his first jersey, he went back to his dorm room and he cried. That's how much it meant to him.
That's true.
Is that a true story?
I can't believe you're still talking about it. Oh yeah, it was true. The dream come true, Tony.
And you cried.
I don't regret it either.
You cried, didn't you?
I cried my eyes out.
Okay.
Yes, I did. I felt that uniform and I thought all the hard work and people that said I'd never make it, I did. And
you drove up for the game today. And you drove up for the game today, right?
Yes.
Okay,
this morning.
So it still matters to you.
Oh, it still matters. Like it does the people that sit around me in the stands, Tony. I remember there was a little girl sitting right in front of me. She could have been more than 8 years old. And she was cheering them on. She had a program out. She knew the players were. And when they were making mistakes, she was saying, block out, block out. I mean, it matters, even to young kids.
Back to our phones. We go to our next call in. Hello and welcome.
Tony, how you doing today, buddy?
You're on the Smart Way Garza Law Firm, Tennessee Basketball Overtime. JB, welcome.
Well, first of all, Tony, for the Periscope folks, Tony, are you drinking moonshine today?
I am not. Why?
I saw the cooler. It's not moonshine?
No, it's but Jeeker. Every time he said Jeeke Jr. or the Cattleman or Philly, I took a drink.
Song, yes.
Yes.
By the way, Tony, the people on Periscope voted turn the lights all the way off. That Coach X shines blinding us off your head. Okay.
That's good. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
It's about the love, Tony. Keith, is it true that you're getting in shape and getting all tight and cut? Lost a lot of weight getting in shape. Is that right?
Keith's doing it for television, aren't you, Keith?
I've lost some. I have dumped some weight, yes.
Are you doing that for the Ella Dorsey lottery, or what's going on?
Well, that's a possibility. You never know. You never know with me. You never know with me.
Unless you have a gun and handcuffs, you're not getting anywhere near Ella Dorsey, big boy.
Now, half that sounds like a good idea.
Guys, I was amazed. This was a real gut shot today, fellas, because a much better team with big people inside and better athletes. We had them on the ropes and we let them off the hook. And we'll remember this in March, looking back, that this one got away. This would be like a Florida-Oklahoma game. But I wanted to speak briefly about I'm pleased about Shambari Phillips and Admiral Schofield. I'm glad that people are acknowledging the talent they have, because as with all Donnie's flaws, he recruited Romello White, Shambari Phillips, and Admiral Schofield, who weren't highly rated guys. And that was a lot more talent than Gonzo recruited his last year. And by the way, this Jalen Johnson kid is a younger or a smaller, quicker version of Romello White. He's very quick. He's an explosive 6'7" kid. He's around the basket. He can play against bigger players. Very exciting. Quay Parker is just Quay Parker's going to be a delight, exciting, quick, explosive player, and Grant Williams is a very underrated player. I think this is a good class, Keith, and I agree with you on that one.
Keith?
Oh, I think this class, I mean, I think I've certainly carried the banner for them. I mean, the only guy that I think is a bit of a project that will take some time, and given what the training staff was able to do with Admiral Schofield's body in a short period of time, I mean, the only one I think isn't going to be game ready, maybe, is Fulkerson. And they've got to get some weight on him. And I'll go ahead and say this. This staff isn't done yet. I'll just leave it at that. It may be sooner than later. This staff isn't done yet.
Guys, you know, we have to give, I criticize Rick because I said he's a guy who recruits well, gets littles and bigs, and he's not much on X's and O's. But he did coach up, somebody did. They've got Schofield and Phillips playing well, even got Mustella playing better at times. So even though I think you could have called some timeouts, Keith made the point, call timeout to do what? Get a brain. I wasn't happy with the runouts, and every time we'd take a shot, they'd release and they'd get easy shots. But I'm going to give Barnes, I was one of his critics, I'm going to give him credit for getting these guys ready to play, and I think that's encouraging to me. So maybe the fire's not out, and maybe he really is ready to coach and help us become a more competitive team. What do you guys think about that?
I agree. And you know me.
I'm right about that, by the way.
I think here's the thing I'm gonna hold out hope on this recruiting class next year. I'm looking at building blocks, okay? And I think we've got some building blocks going forward. And it only takes a couple. You hit on a couple guys. If Shambari Phillips continues to come, I think Schofield's going to be an all-league basketball player, and it might be sooner than later. I'm talking like next year, if he continues to develop. And so, JB, when you start thinking about that, all you've got to get now, even though the guy's kind of a little bit of a lughead and he drives you nuts, Mostella can score. He can still play. He can score. He showed it today.
He has ability, Tony. He has ability. He can play in the right circumstances.
And Hubs will be a senior next year. That's not going to be a bad team because they're going to get some point guard help. The thing that breaks my heart is, the thing I'd love to have seen with this group is Rob Gray was on this campus the day Tindall got fired. It'd been nice if this staff could have gotten him because he's a hell of a player at Houston. You talk about a guy Tindall had, and Tindall told me and Keith another thing that he won't admit on the air, but they had that Gwynn guy from East Tennessee State, fifth-year player. They had him in their back pocket. He was going to go there rather than East Tennessee State. He would have been a very good player here. They'd had a nice team. And they're going to, I think, if you guys are right, and I'm going to hold out hope that you are, on the premise that nobody thought Shambari Phillips could play, nobody thought Admiral Schofield could play. If Konzo Martin wouldn't have run off his class, his last act of cowardice here, if he wouldn't have run off his class, this would have been a nice basketball team this year. You add a Kofor to that. You add a couple of those bodies to that. And that's a disgrace. And he gets away with that, JB. And nobody says anything about that. And that
he
is
ran
a damn
off several players, the present players and future players, and even ran off Romello White. So we know he did this. But
disgrace.
If Barnes can go out in the 17 class and get a real rim protector, a rebounder, a defensive specialist, the team is playing so much better, and they're getting better. They're responding to coaching to somebody, and whether it's Barnes or not, they're playing better. That gives me some hope. But this is a gut shot. This is a gut check. And we have seniors. We've got guys who have been here with our seniors now. They're junior college kids, but they played. Armani's been here a while. They've got to rally this team, get them back up, get them out of the depths, and realize this is not the end of the world. You can go on film and see, look, if they're going to release them, you've got to get back. You've got to get back and play defense. Don't roll on the floor. Call a timeout at the right time. Don't make a stupid shot. Those are all correctable errors. Those are things that can be corrected. We all know that if Armani calls the timeout, we don't roll on the floor, or we Hubs takes a stupid shot, we probably win the ball game. We all know this. Fellas, thank you very much, and thank you for the show.
Hey, thank you. What about it, Griff? These are correctable errors, and this thing here is very correctable, what happened today, and not crushing.
No, it's not crushing at all, Tony. And as a matter of fact, if Tennessee would have lost by 15 today, our tone would have been completely different. We would have been, and Tony, you would have been saying, hey, it's what you expected all along. It's just the loss is tougher when you've got it within the grasp of your hands and let it go. If they had lost by 15, and we would have been having a much different conversation today saying how great Texas A&M was and how Tennessee's developing their young people.
Griff, we're saying that Keith Hatfield and myself agree with one thing about you. You, at the time you've been on here, you've always been a perfect gentleman. This is Mark Griffin, who's joined us for some of these Smart Way, Garza Law Firm, Tennessee Basketball Overtime programs. And when he does, it's a real blessing. Because Mark Griffin, Keith, explain to him what he does not do that some of these guys that play do, Keith.
Oh, no, Mark's fantastic in that Mark gives you a player's perspective, but he doesn't do what I consider the idiotic Mike Golic thing that you don't know because you've never had your hand in the dirt, blah, blah, blah. I mean, certainly, I'm not going to claim that I have the kind of knowledge Mark has because, I mean, Mark's been out there. But I also, I don't have to be a five-star chef to know when food tastes like crap. I think Griff gives us great perspective without just acting as if, well, only I know and you guys are just sitting there running your mouths. I hope Griff joins us every time we fire one of these up.
I've always found you, Mark, to be that way. In our friendship and on the air and off the air, you've never pulled rank on me and said, Tony, the closest you could have gotten to my career was maybe being fortunate enough to clean my jock strap.
Well, it's been a pleasure. It's a pleasure to talk about the Vols and, working with you and Hatfield, and it's really nice, and having your callers call in and give their opinion. That's what call shows are about, is give their opinion. We don't have to agree with everything, and I'm not right in everything, but all I want, Tony, is a competitive five to get out there and play as hard as they can.
That's right.
Win or lose.
That's right.
Is just show the Tennessee faithful that you're working hard and you're trying to get better. And you're trying to make this university proud and do the right thing. That's all you can ask. Yes, I'd love for them to go to the postseason tournament like everyone else and do well, win championships. And I do think that we have the right man that's running the ship right now with Coach Barnes. It's just going to take time. But they've already exceeded some expectations that I thought that they would, you know, accomplish this year already, especially individually. Hopefully more team down the road. But it's going to be a good ride the rest of the season. And like Hatfield discussed earlier this next week with games, you know, at Georgia, Mississippi State, you know, those are winnable games. And you got to let this game get behind you now and watch that game tape and then put it behind and know going in at Georgia, if you're in the same situation, maybe these guys will react different. Because, Tony, as a student athlete, you're used to going through similar situations while you're on the court or on the field. And you sit there, and in your mind, you internally tell yourself, I've been through this, and this is what happened, and this is what I can control to make it happen differently, have a different outcome. So in a sense, it's not bad that they went through this, as long as they can learn from it.
Well, that's right. And one final thing, guys. Vol Colonel just shot me a great tweet out in the cyberspace, me and his several thousand followers. And that's that South Carolina did end up beating Vanderbilt today. They're 15-0, Keith.
Vanderbilt will cash in, and they will have a new basketball coach next year.
Vandy's now 8-7. Mark Griffin. Vandy is 8-7. Griff, did you?
A shocker.
And that was supposed to be a nice team coming back, one of the better teams in the league.
Preseason top 25, Tony. I don't know what number they were, but weren't they like 18 or so?
Yeah. Well, Jeff Goodman said he thought they would win the SEC, and I didn't argue with him too hard. I certainly thought they'd be right there. Cornette getting hurt hurts him a little bit. He's back now. And Luke Cornette's a good player, but he's not the difference between being a top 25 team and being a 500 team against a pretty mediocre schedule. So, I mean, they've got no excuses for where they're at.
And with Cornette, too, I'm you know, living in Nashville, get a lot of Vanderbilt coverage. I don't mind him camping out the three-point line. You're 7-1, and you want to shoot threes, and he's shooting like 20% this year. Keep shooting, big boy. Because that's not really contributing to what they need, and you're right, they're having some issues, and I really don't mind that they're not winning.
Absolutely. Well, and it probably doesn't help when your best player announces before the season even starts that he's going pro. I mean, Damian Jones announces before the first tip-off this year that he's going pro. I can't imagine that helps.
Plus, Stallings is more old school, and I know people that have played for him, and a lot of times at the end of the season, these guys burn out. Now they haven't burned. I mean, I'm a little shocked that they've started off how they have. I figured they would start out hotter and then burn out and lose more games toward the end of the season because he burns them out. I've heard players say they couldn't wait to go on spring break because they're so worn out by the verbal abuse, if you could call it that, on talk show radio that he goes through, the players go through under Stallings. I mean, he's just so hard on these kids.
Well, that's certainly how they've played in every NCAA, almost every NCAA tournament they've made under him.
Griff, that's kind of a shocking development, something we'll watch as the season unfolds, and I really appreciate your time. One other thing. It's going to be fun to watch LSU. It's going to be fun to watch Kentucky.
Yeah.
And if they get it together or not, because here's the thing about what we've seen up there with him. Some of his cakes are winners at the fair over there in Mount Pilot. And some of them are like Aunt Bee's pickles. He's got teams that are like Aunt Bee's pickles, guys. Now, I don't know where this Kentucky team falls, but some of his little hodgepodge AAU teams can't play.
Well, let's be honest, Tony. Other than the year that Noel got hurt, what's the earliest they've been beaten in the tournament since he's been there, the Elite Eight? I mean, I'll take those runs. I mean, that's the earliest they've been eliminated from the NCAA tournament except the year Noel got hurt and Robert Morris beat them in the NIT.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Griff, give me a final thought here on the way out, and I love you, Mark Griffin. You're a good man, and I appreciate your heart. And like I told you before off the air the other day, I'm going to say it to you in person. Whatever you have going forward, I and this radio family are in with you lock, stock, and barrel.
Now, I just wanted to give a shout-out, Tony, if I could. I'm passing on your app to a couple people and just want to say hello, if that's okay.
Go ahead, because there are thousands listening.
There are thousands and many more waiting. Linda is my mom, who's listening in West Tennessee. So she's listening, and I also want to say hi to my friend Carla.
Always giving a shout out to the ladies, Griff. I love you. It'll never change. It's just the way it is, as the great Bruce Hornsby once said.
There ain't nothing wrong with that, though.
Hatfield, your New Year's Eve date fell asleep, bro. Griff, thank you.
thank you, guys.
Have a safe trip back. Keith, on the way out, give me a final thought here. You've been a gentleman, a scholar.
Well, I mean, Tennessee certainly let one kind of slip through their hands tonight. I mean, that's just incredibly frustrating. But, I mean, you go out, and now if Vanderbilt's struggling, I mean, the next three, you go play two winnable road games, and you get a Vanderbilt team that I think at this point is just as likely to pitch it in and be done with it as they are to be resilient and fight. So, I mean, you come out and get these next three, you'll be 4-2, bringing South Carolina into Thompson Bowling on a Saturday. So, I mean, you can kind of put together a nice little situation and have a good crowd for that. I mean, have some fun with it. One thing off topic, Tony, I do want to say, when you've got like a complete NBA roster of prospects every year within almost walking distance of your campus, how the hell is Rutgers this bad every year? I mean, they should be able to hire Jerry Green and make the tournament. And they look like right now that I'm pretty sure Halls High School would drill their eyes shut.
How about St. John's? You ever think you'd live to see a day where who was it that beat the absolute living hell out of St. John's earlier in the year? It was somebody crazy.
Oh yeah, it was like American or somebody like that. No, it was Incarnate Word. It was
Incarnate Word.
It was Incarnate Word. Oh yeah, I mean,
plastered him.
But Mullen's smart. He went and hired two of probably the five best recruiters in the country. People better get their licks in on them now because that ain't gonna last long.
But yeah, they're all well. That's what happens when you hire Steve Lavin. Well, let me take that back. That's what happens when you follow Mike Jarvis and Norm Roberts with Steve Lavin. They've done a really bad job of hiring coaches.
And they
that'll
wander,
do it to you every
and
time.
They and they wandered in from the city of St. I'm trying to get the Royal Scam in my head, which is the city of St. John. That's why I thought about that. I think I was in the wrong key there. Hatfield, final thought on the way out. By the way, inquiring minds are wondering, including a couple people that have texted me. They want me to, what's the word, gig you, perhaps, on the Steelers and Bengals. Do you have a thought on this? And by the way, if the Chiefs don't win this game today, because I know they've had a bad postseason history. They're up 13-0, 7 minutes to play till halftime. If they don't win that game, they might as well, as we say in the trade, walk off the field. Hatfield, on the way out, laid on me.
Oh, there's no doubt that the Bengals are going to lose. The Bengals are never beating the Steelers in a playoff game. I'm not dumb enough. I don't believe in unicorns and stuff. Steelers will win tonight. That's what happens when the Steelers and Bengals play meaningful games. I'm not an idiot. Now, if the Bengals win, I'll put it this way. I've got some Powerball tickets sitting here. I think I'm more likely going to be going to Nashville to collect about $600 million on the cash option Monday than I am to see the Bengals win tonight. That's how confident I am in A.J. McCarron and the Bengals' history against the Steelers.
Yeah, it's a shame. What I heard about, what bothers me about the city of Cincinnati is that you work that hard to get to that spot, you have a team that's capable of going to the Super Bowl, and in a year where that's possible, from a fan base that's been through so much, you lose Big Red, and you just can't.
I never dreamed I would miss Andy Dalton.
You miss him. I mean, you just can't.
I miss him very badly right now.
That's not a drop-off. That's like falling off a cliff.
Yeah, well, and I mean, McCarron's played okay, but there's no way he's going to play. The only thing that may save him tonight is that Pittsburgh's defense isn't very good. Maybe the only thing that keeps it from being a complete slaughter tonight, because I have no doubt Roethlisberger will come out and throw for about 450 and be damn near perfect, as he always is in games, almost always is in games that matter against the Bengals. So A.J. McCarron better have his Frank Reich magic tonight, or the Bengals are going to get hammered.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, You look at the way that game is going to be tonight, and I think we're fixing to see us a blowout. You know?
Well, what happens?
I told Ewad that today. He didn't like it, but not much I can do about
essentially,
it.
Essentially, the Bengals are Lex Luger to the Steelers' Ric Flair. Always have been, always will be. No matter how good the Bengals look, how hyped up they are, how much it looks like their time, they're never getting past them. Ever. And I'll refuse to believe it's going to happen until I actually see it happen. That's two Lex Luger references in a week out of me, isn't it? I think I made fun of Michael White's dress shirt the other night.
Hatfield, you're the living, breathing, absolute best. One more time, your appearance today was presented by
Clancy's Tavern and Whiskey House in downtown Knoxville, next to the Historic Tennessee Theater, where I anticipate I will be in about 4 minutes and 45 seconds.
Hatfield, I love you like a brother, man. Once you're around, don't go too hard, okay?
I got you. I got a long day tomorrow, Tone. It'll be for me a very docile evening.
Love you, brother. Thank you.
Love you too, Tone. Talk to you soon.
That was a lot of fun. Next time we do this again, Tennessee's going to win. In fact, the next two times we do this again, Tennessee's going to win. Until we meet again, I want to thank my friends at Smartway, online at gosmartway.net. Also, easy for me to say, your Garza Law Firm. And I want to thank those of you that have been with us from pillar to post, today. Marcos Garza, if you're listening, tncriminallaw.com. Thank you, sir. I want to thank the boys and girls and all the ships at sea listening to us tonight. I want to remind you one more time that a Tennessee team that's hovering around 500 had a 1 o'clock tip-off today in Thompson Bowling Arena, and there was greater than 13,000 to 14,000 people there. Now listen to me. That is a sellout for most programs in this country. We just did a post-game show. The game ended at roughly, I want to say, 3 o'clock Eastern time. It is 5:40. We've been going for 2 hours and 40 minutes. Now, that's 2 hours and 40 minutes of fun and frivolity. That was a pretty tough show to do today. I want to thank all those that have tuned in on the app, all of my Twidiots that are out there. I love each and every one of you. My Twidiots are beloved. You are special people. I want to thank you for being there as well, our Periscopers. I want to thank the people named Patrishka and Borboshka. And I want to thank all the people in Minsk who are watching us today. All the Sergeys watching us today over in Russia, number one, and Iran, number one. I want to thank each and every one of you. I want to thank all our friends in Latvia and Estonia, all the people named Jan over in Estonia, in Estonia today. Thank you so much for being there. And to the radio listener, to the app listener, I'm going to throw it on, and we're going to throw a couple of great book corners at you here. You're going to love it like a brother, and that's how it's got to stay. In fact, let's do a little Grateful Dead, cultural significance of the Grateful Dead here, which is kind of apropos for what the Vols did today. Peter Richardson is joining, author of A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. The book is called No Simple Highway, and Peter Richardson is nice enough to join. Peter, first thing I want to do is welcome you aboard, and it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Tony. It's a great pleasure for me.
Let's talk, if we can, about the Grateful Dead. In the news here recently, did you plan the release of this book to coincide with the huge summer of the Grateful Dead?
Yeah, we had the 50th anniversary in mind. My publisher and editor is also the editor of Bill Kreutzmann's memoir, and we gave it a little bit of thought. We had both of these books coming out from the same publisher. We didn't think the books were competitive in any direct way. They're very different in their coverage and tone and everything else, but we tried to separate the books by a few months, and my editor said, what if we brought out your book in January? I said, that's fine. Billy Kreutzmann's book was coming in a little later anyway. And what we didn't know is that 4 days before the release of the book, the remaining members of the Grateful Dead would announce the Chicago shows. That announcement came on January 16th, and No Simple Highway dropped on January 20th. That was great timing, nothing planned out, of course, to coordinate those things, but it did work out nicely, I think.
I think we all love happy accidents, don't we, in our industry?
Yeah, a little synchronicity, as the Deadheads would say.
I used to have a general manager in radio used to tell me, put yourself out in front of a parade, which it's interesting. Instead of trying to create your own parades, you put yourself out in front of parades, you look a lot better. And you know, the Grateful Dead, through the years, it's almost as if they were reluctant musical heroes from the outset of their story.
Yeah, certainly Jerry Garcia fits that mold. He was never really one to try to assert himself too powerfully, either within the band or in public in general. In fact, toward somewhere in the middle of their 30-year career, he basically stopped speaking from the stage because people were taking what he said so seriously. But even in the Dead's organization, he was reluctant to take a strong hand. One thing we learned, even the Grateful Dead learned, when they hired Sam Cutler after Altamont, Sam Cutler had been working for the Rolling Stones. Jerry Garcia said, well, how do the Rolling Stones make decisions? And Sam Cutler said, oh, well, Mick makes all the decisions. And Jerry Garcia couldn't believe it. It just seemed so alien to him, so foreign, because everything they did was so egalitarian and participatory. Everything depended on making sure that the group was good with it. And there were these concentric circles of what constituted the group. First there was the band, then there was the organization, then there was the kind of friends and family, and then there was the deadheads. And I mean, they were very conscious of the various communities that they were working in. And the whole idea from the very beginning was to grow those groups, not to sort of stage themselves to those groups.
And that's what's really interesting about the Grateful Dead. You really build on this throughout the book. There's a communal sense of who they are, and you draw a parallel with the Rolling Stones. You introduced it, and you talk in the book a little bit about it as well. From the standpoint, the Rolling Stones, people I've talked to about their organization through the years, Andrew Oldham and Mick Jagger and the new form of the Stones that we've seen, they are pure commercialism. I mean, they are purely out there to make the dollar. They charge their fans huge money. That's never been a problem for them. Whereas the Dead has always been almost anti-commerce. They've made it almost in spite of themselves, in a business sense. They've made it work almost in spite of themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. It's a very kind of intriguing question, really, about the way the Dead have run their business over the years. I don't think they were ever, and in fact they've said publicly, you know, we never took a vow of poverty. We never said that music should be free. They knew just how hard they were working to stay vital and to stay whole as an enterprise. They had some setbacks. They had some financial setbacks that they had to work themselves out of a couple of holes at various times, and they worked very hard. But from the beginning, they were basically tribal as well as utopian, and their business model kind of depended on building up their community and fostering a kind of community loyalty to them. That gave them a lot of commercial freedom, because as long as people were coming out to the concerts, they could continue to explore their own musical passions. But the main thing was that they invented their organization. They invented every aspect of their organization, from their instruments to the way they produced and distributed their music. I mean, there was a kind of do-it-yourself ethos really from the very beginning. And in the book, No Simple Highway, I try to show how that sensibility, that orientation, really grew out of a kind of post-war bohemian community that the Dead discovered and was in circulation well before the Dead started their business. But if you look at the way they did their business, you can trace it back to these underlying values, which were remarkably stable. And the most important value, I think, as you said, was this dedication to the notion of community.
And the community grew from these small, which were called acid tests, where they really got together and first started to play. In the beginning, it was almost like there was a reluctance on their part, that there were all of a sudden expectations on them. Even in a small circle, people enjoyed them, and from the beginning, I sensed almost a reluctance from your characterization of them as they launched.
I think they wanted to build their community as fast as they could, but you're right. I mean, first of all, in those acid tests and some of those early gigs that they had before they really hit it big, they were still learning their instruments. I mean, you know, Phil Lesh was quite surprised when Jerry Garcia said, "Hey man, we need a new bass player. We think it should be you." And Phil Lesh said, "I've never played the bass in my life." He had been a trumpet player until that moment. So they started gigging around the Bay Area, and, you know, they were still learning how to play. The acid test, Ken Kesey's acid test, Ken Kesey and the Married Pranksters had these events, and they weren't really gigs. I mean, they were really more super rave kind of parties where the Dead would get up and play. Sometimes they played a little bit. Sometimes they played long. Sometimes they were too freaked out to play and they just walked away. But that was the model scene for them. From the beginning, they loved those kind of super energetic, super improvisatory, super interactive kind of music scene. So they wanted to play these smaller venues. What they were reluctant about was really playing large venues where they didn't really feel like they could get that kind of ecstatic rapture, which was their goal every time they went out to play. They really wanted to take people higher through music, and it was harder to do in those bigger venues. So they were reluctant to play those. Eventually, they made their peace with those larger venues as well, and they adjusted their music to play things that would work in that kind of setting. And when you look at these shows that they did this summer, in the Fare Thee Well in Chicago and Santa Clara, you could see they were making those adjustments as well. What can work in that setting? And it's very different from what can work in these more intimate venues that they've started playing in and that were really sort of what they really love to do, playing these ballrooms in San Francisco, for example, which was much, much more intimate. And, you know, they weren't removed from the audience, and they could pick up on the audience's energy and then feed it back to them. And that's something that they really enjoyed. But over time, they had to make those changes, partly because they had these other commitments that they had made to their community. I mean, they really wanted to keep their friends employed, for one thing, and also serve their audiences. And over time, that meant playing arenas and then eventually the stadiums as well.
It's just a really interesting story as we visit today with Peter Richardson. The book is called Cultural History of the Grateful Dead, No Simple Highway. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. Of course, the late, great Jerry Garcia, it's hard to believe he's been gone as long as he has. You made a point about his past and his childhood and the fascination he had throughout really his entire life, but even early on, with American roots music. And how, for the Grateful Dead, it was never going to be, we're here to write three-minute pop songs, be famous, sell records. If anything, and you talk about this, early on, there was a real difficulty for them to translate what they were doing to vinyl. It was a difficult translation, wasn't it, with their early records?
Yeah, it was. They didn't have a lot of experience in the studio when they signed their first deal with Warner Brothers. You know, they went down and they played, and the recording was just them, kind of their live sound, a little bit too fast, they thought later, that it was a little bit too up-tempo, and they never really captured the magic of their live performances on vinyl. That began to change a little bit. Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, that was a kind of turning point for them, because those albums were short, relatively simple songs that could be played on the radio, and that really helped build their audience. And then behind those albums, they were able to build their big touring machine. But their live performances, even of some of the songs on those albums, were always quite different. They would lead out to long improvised jams, and you know, the improvisation was not just one guy improvising on top of the band, but everybody improvising at the same time. That was a kind of fearless experiment that they regularly undertook in their live performances. I think for anybody, that's kind of hard to capture live. But they did do some live albums that you can get a feeling for that, like Europe 72 or Live Dead, or these are some of the early ones. So they always were trying to mix it up. They never wanted to be defined by the two sort of more soulful, acoustic albums of Working Man's Dead and American Beauty. But for many people, millions of Americans, those two albums really are some of the favorites. I think for the hardcore Deadheads, you have to go to the tapes. And that taping culture really built up over the 1970s, and that ended up really changing the Deadhead community and the way that people felt about the live music, too.
What's interesting about their story, you have all these parallel figures that are a part of the culture out there, who become a part of the Grateful Dead and their story, and especially from early on. And we talk about how their music didn't translate, and they had to find ways to eat, and there were some enterprising individuals out there, like Owsley Stanley's a real interesting story to look at, a guy that was on the periphery, yet is a big part of what became the Dead in that culture.
Oh yeah, Owsley Stanley is a really important part of the Dead story for a couple different reasons. One was he was their early patron. I mean, he paid the bills. I mean, they had a shelter and food because of Owsley Stanley. He also was kind of their visionary when it came to their sound system, which was very important to their development as well. They never, early on especially, they never stopped exploring and reinvesting in their sound system. And of course, that made those live gigs a great treat. I mean, they had high fidelity sound up to like a quarter mile. And of course, that prompted more and more taping. And that taping, again, became a big part of the Dead's legacy and their what they became known for. The main thing that he's known for, really, is producing high-quality LSD, and was one of the early manufacturers of LSD, especially in the San Francisco Bay Area. And of course, at that time, early on, LSD was legal. when he became involved with the Grateful Dead, he was manufacturing and distributing LSD, which was outlawed in October of 1966. And after that, his position in the band, when it became illegal, and he had some legal problems later, his position in the band weakened a little bit. He wasn't sound guru that he had been early on. And he was also one of the first people to tape their performances and play it back for them so that they could hear what they sounded like. So at very many levels, Owsley Stanley was, I mean, he was an important person in American culture anyway, but he was an especially important person in the Grateful Dead.
His patronage, as you were talking about before, and just keeping these guys up while they were learning the ropes, and it's almost as if they weren't seasoned musicians. Obviously, Garcia was becoming more and more proficient and quickly was becoming a world-level type of player with his background, but Bob Weir was a guy that was one of his guitar students. We're used to seeing the finished product. But early on, it was not a rosy picture for those guys. A lot of struggles.
Yeah, and you know, they never rested on their laurels or became a nostalgia act the way other bands, even from the same period, did, where they went around and just played their greatest hits, kind of more or less by recital. I mean, all along, they were exploring new territory and very rarely playing the same arrangements of songs. There was a lot to keep up with. And somebody like Phil Lesh, who shared with Jerry Garcia this kind of bottomless appetite for innovation and music and new kinds of music, for someone like Pigpen, Ron McKernan, or Bob Weir, they had a lot to keep up with.